From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Houston Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Excellent, thank
you. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Now, when it comes to the Iran deal, President Obama could have a problem gaining support within his own party, except when it comes to some Massachusetts Democrats. Here with us in Studio 3 is one of them, Congressman Seth Moulton. And closer to home, he's fighting to protect the lobster industry, which could explain why it appears his favorite meal to cook is lobster Alfredo fettuccine. We'll find out about that, too.
Ooh.
Congressman Moulton, it's great to see you.
Oh,
great
my
to be
goodness.
Back. Thanks for having me.
I don't like lobster, but with a fettuccine Alfredo sauce, that could
be pretty
good.
Well, and it's homemade. It's not bad.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Okay. Well, let's talk about something that's not nearly as much fun as lobster fettuccine Alfredo. You just came back from a trip to Israel, and you have come out in favor of the Iran deal. And I said to you before we went on the air, what are the chances of it withstanding a veto? Because things are not looking great for it. What do you think, Congressman Moulton, about it withstanding, that if Barack Obama vetoes any put down of it, it will survive?
Well, my guess is that it will be okay, but it's not clear. There are an awful lot of lawmakers who have not come out with a position yet. And it's because I think that it's very easy to come up with criticisms of the deal, to poke holes in it, to say it's not a perfect deal, we would have liked to see this or that. It's much harder to do the analysis of the alternatives and realize that even though it is an imperfect deal, it's still the best option that we have to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
So why are so many of your fellow Democrats not seeing that perspective?
Well, I think, frankly, it just takes time. It takes time to do the analysis, to ask the tough questions. There are some issues that I had with the agreement as well. For example, I was very concerned about the 24-day wait period for the inspections. Having had some classified briefings, those concerns have been allayed. But I had to go have those briefings to understand exactly how we could still detect if they had any violations of the agreement. And so it's not easy to come to yes on this. It's, in fact, I think politically much easier just to say, oh, it's, you know, it could be stronger, and so I'm going to reject it.
When you said your statement, you did say you said it could theoretically be stronger. What does that mean?
Look, we negotiated with an adversary. This isn't, Jim and Seth planning a great night out. I mean, this is a negotiation among people who don't agree.
That would be a tough negotiation, too, Congressman.
Well,
that would be clear. But go right ahead. I want to.
He's very picky, Congressman.
Can we talk about a couple of meetings you were in? You were amongst a relatively small group of people who met with the president. Is that not correct at the White House? Did you or did you not?
That's right.
And describe that to us. How many people were there? Who was there? What was that like hearing a pitch directly from the leader of the free world?
Well, that particular meeting was mostly freshman Democrats, and he brought us in and sat down in a very small room in the Situation Room, and we talked about it in detail. He gave a very in-depth brief about why he thought that it was not only the best alternative but also a good deal, and we asked questions. I actually disagree in the sense that I don't think it's a great deal. But I do think it's the best alternative. And we live in a real world where we have to choose an alternative. We don't have the luxury of just saying, well, I don't like this. It's not as good as I would like to see it, and therefore we can reject it. We have to make a choice here. And there are really only two alternatives. We either go to war immediately, because Iran is already a threshold nuclear state. I mean,
months.
Maybe even just one or two months before they could create a bomb. So either, if we don't accept this deal, we either go to war immediately, or the only other thing we could do is try to negotiate a better deal. But everybody says the sanctions are going to fall apart, at least in part, maybe completely. So explain to me how you can negotiate a better deal with less leverage.
Why can't the sanctions be strengthened, which is apparently the third course, which a lot of Republicans and some of your fellow Democrats who were against the president on this, why isn't that an option?
Because the only way that the sanctions have worked is because they've been an international coalition. It's not just the United States here. It's China. It's Russia. It's India. And we actually had a very good conversation with the negotiator for the sanctions under President Bush, who said India, China, Russia, they're so anxious to get into the Iran economy. They've already made it clear that they're going to release their sanctions with or without this deal. So basically, Iran is going to get all this money anyway. Do we want them to get the money without any restrictions on their program, or do we want to sign the deal that we all agreed to make sure that we can prevent them from getting a nuclear bomb?
We're talking to Congressman Seth Moulton. I want to stay on those meetings just for a second. When you meet with the president in that kind of setting on something that matters as much to him, in addition to making his case and answering questions, does he put members of Congress on the spot there, or that's not his style? Meaning, does he go around the room and say, how are you as of this moment? Where are you all leaning? Does he do that kind of thing?
He didn't do that, but he did make it clear to all of us as a group that he thought it was very important that we support this deal. But look, I've been opposed to the president on many foreign policy issues. I've been very outspoken about my disagreements with him in how he's been dealing with ISIS. I've been strongly opposed to his decision to send more troops into Iraq without a clear strategy for what they're going to do. So personally, I don't have any problem disagreeing with the president, especially on matters of foreign policy. It's just that in this case, I agree with his arguments. I think he's right.
I want to stay on meetings one more time. You went with a bunch of congresspeople to Israel. And obviously, everybody knows that the Netanyahu has made quite clear, as of other Israeli leaders, how horrible they think this deal is. How many members other than you had come out in favor of the deal when you were there?
I was the only one.
Out of how many?
There were 20 Democrats, and then about 40 Republicans joined us at the end. So at that last dinner, we had joint Democrat and Republican with 100, 125 people. I was the only one in the room who would come out and support
the deal. How uncomfortable was that for you?
It's all right. I mean, look, I've been in uncomfortable situations before in my life.
Believe me, I know you have. But did they make you feel uncomfortable?
No, they didn't. It was very respectful. Look, at the end of the day, we share the Israelis' views on what needs to happen here. We both agree that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. This is not like one of us says, well, maybe it's okay if they do, and the other says, absolutely no way. No, we both agree that Iran must not have a nuclear weapon, that they are a state sponsor of terrorism, that they are a sworn enemy of the United States and our allies. We just disagree on how to best get there. So all the meetings that we had in Israel were actually very respectful. The prime minister spent 2 hours with us giving his brief on why he thought that it's a bad deal. Interestingly, never mentioning what he thought would be a better alternative until we really pressed him on it. But giving his brief and then answering our questions for almost 2 hours. So,
were you nervous going into that meeting, knowing that you, I assume, knew that he knew that there was one person in the room who was against them formally, and you were it? Were you nervous about that?
No, I wasn't nervous, but I thought it put me in a good place to ask some important questions. And the one question that I really wanted to ask, and I asked the president of Israel the same question, is what should we be doing to advance our partnership? After this deal, what can we do to restore, repair, and strengthen the historic and always nonpartisan alliance that we've had with the state of Israel?
What's the answer?
Well, I think we have a lot of work to do. And, you know, I think that part of what's coming out of this is that Israeli opposition to the deal will give them some leverage to ask us for some more support.
And yet your position, and I just want to be clear about this, is this, if this deal falls apart, then in a month or two, Iran will have nuclear capability.
Well, they certainly could. I mean, there's debate among experts as to what path they would choose if we reject this deal.
Well, so this is what I don't understand. If we're trying to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon and people are talking about going back again to the negotiating table and going back and putting in stronger sanctions, even though the other countries have said they're not interested in going there, we're only weeks away now. This is the part I don't understand about the opposition. I mean, you heard this over in Israel. They talked about the opposition. They're right. They're much more in the firing line than we are. I mean, they must realize that they're close to having a nuclear weapon now.
Well, Marjorie, I don't understand that either, because that is a huge risk. That you've stated it quite accurately. Iran could have a weapon within weeks if we reject this deal. So the whole idea that we can go back to the negotiating table, really start from scratch with new sanctions and try to make them stronger and there's almost no one who thinks they can actually make them stronger, and then somehow with less leverage negotiate a better deal all the while Iran can just create a bomb overnight. I mean, I just don't think it's a responsible course of action. So I don't think this is a perfect deal. And it's very easy to point out the ways in which it could be stronger, could be better. But I think it's the best option we have.
One last thing on Iran, at least from me, Congressman Alden. There's a move afoot. You probably know the probable next Democratic leader in the Senate is Chuck Schumer. Do you support the movement to have Amy Schumer be the leader in the Senate rather than Chuck Schumer? Is that a lot of... Okay.
Thanks. You know, I don't think I'm allowed to vote on that. But, okay. You know,
are you troubled by that? Incidentally, the thing that troubled me most, and I don't have a dog in this hunt or whatever that expression is. If Schumer honestly believes, the senator from New York, obviously he is apparently has the votes to succeed Harry Reid as a Democratic leader. If he has so confident in his position, were you not struck by the fact that he just chose to release this at the same time that the Fox News debate was going on to ensure that it get absolutely minimum contemporaneous coverage? I mean, you're in politics. That's not an accident, is it?
No, it's not an accident. I thought it was very strange. I'm not really interested in all the politics of this. We just got to make sure we make the right decision. And if you read Senator Schumer's statement, it's very thoughtful. Someone on my team counted it up. It's 60 sentences long. I think out of 60 sentences, he devotes one to what we should do as an alternative. So it's the same old argument. It's the same old litany of reasons why we could have negotiated a stronger deal or we could have better terms.
So what's it about the power of AIPAC, the power of Israel? What's Schumer's – well, you don't have to – what's the motivation of legislators, Democratic legislators in particular, who have moved fairly quickly in this direction? While people like the most senior Jewish members of the Senate, as you know, are Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. They're supporting this thing. Is it Israel? Is it about Israel?
I'm not sure. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. But that's why I'm working hard to not to pressure my colleagues, but to really answer their questions. And to I've put a very comprehensive statement on my website, and then a response to all the criticisms that AIPAC and others have put forward about this deal to show people that you can reason your way through this, and if you're thoughtful and really think about where the different alternatives put us, the deal is the best option. It's important to say, even in a worst-case scenario, if you think that there's the only way we're going to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon is eventually to go to war with them. I certainly hope that doesn't happen. But even if you're in that extremist camp, the deal puts us in a better position because it gives us more credibility to do so because we've tried the diplomatic option first, and it gives us way more intelligence because we'll be in the country conducting these inspections.
We're talking with Congressman Seth Moulton. Congressman, we talked to you about this, and you were in Iraq, and you saw action and served in the military there, about ISIS before and how to combat ISIS. And you said before you disagreed with the president about it. Every time I read something about ISIS, it's often predicated by, well, despite 4,000 airstrikes, and then despite 5,000 airstrikes, and now despite 6,000 airstrikes, keeps going up the number of airstrikes, ISIS continues to spread, and there's this story, of course, that you're well aware of. This militant group affiliated with ISIS claims to have beheaded this Croatian worker who was kidnapped near Cairo last month. So on the one hand, I understand why you're saying we don't want to put more troops in there. On the other hand, we seem not to be making any progress.
Well, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but I'm going to say the same thing I did the last time I was on the show, which is that this is fundamentally a political problem. It's not just a military problem. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't need military action here, and there are cases where the airstrikes have helped. But we've got to have a comprehensive political and diplomatic plan for the Middle East to defeat ISIS. That means defeating ISIS not just by killing their operatives, but by defeating them on social media, by making sure that we have political opposition in place to take their spot. In Iraq, where ISIS has grown and expanded so much, we've got to have a serious political and diplomatic solution to prevent the vacuum, to replace the vacuum that failed Iraqi politics have left and allowed ISIS to grow. So we have a lot of work to do here, and I still don't feel like we have that strong political and diplomatic strategy that we need to ensure ISIS's defeat.
And now, of course, we have Egypt and Cairo, which is a place that not long ago was a place everyone wanted to go visit, to go see the pyramids. And now you're thinking to yourself, I don't think so. I don't want to. I mean, the unrest in Egypt is just really frightening, and it encompasses ISIS now, too.
It is frightening. But, you know, the opportunity here, the place where the glass is half full, is that ISIS is created such a threat to so many different states in the Middle East that it's an opportunity for us to help bring them together. But I think one of the messages that I heard in my latest trip to the Middle East, and I was previously there in February, is that people are still looking for American leadership. We're excited to see countries like Jordan and the UAE standing up and actually taking action, doing something themselves. We don't want more American troops on the ground in the Middle East, so we need to get these other nations to do their part. But they're still looking for American strategic leadership, for America to come in and say, we need to come together as an alliance. This is the strategy that we need, and here's where we can support you as you put your troops forward.
Do you have an idea of what would be a good diplomatic plan?
Well, I think one thing we need to do is we really need to focus on building these alliances, on getting states like Jordan and the UAE to come together and really have a comprehensive plan. Not just you're doing a few airstrikes here and you're doing a few airstrikes there, but let's sit down at the table and really talk about, for example, with Syria. What is Syria really going to look like post an Assad regime? I don't think anyone in there really knows. I don't think there's a guiding vision that says this is where we want to go with this broken country. And the Middle East is looking for that.
And why do you think this isn't happening?
Well, I'm not sure. But I think that there's a sentiment that we all just want to get out of the Middle East. And certainly the president was elected on the promise of getting out of the Middle East, pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think at the end of the day, while it's right to pull out our troops and we don't need another ground war in the Middle East, we still need American leadership in this incredibly difficult part of the globe. And frankly, we see what happens when we don't provide that leadership. I mean, here the president who, you know, ran on pulling troops out of Iraq has had to send them back in just 5 years after they left.
We're talking to Seth Moulton, a congressman from North Shore here in Massachusetts. Do you have a candidate in the presidential race, Seth Moulton?
No, I don't. You know, I'm a freshman, just 7 months in, and I'm not sure that they feel they care too much who I would endorse. But
you
I'm just focused on.
I assume whether they care or not. Do you feel, based on what you know so far, Sanders, O'Malley, Clinton? Who do you think is better on the things you care most about, even if you're not ready to endorse anybody?
Well, I agree with a lot of Secretary Clinton's positions, and I think that she has some important experience that she brings to the table that is about as strong in the entire field of candidates, Republican or Democrat. I think she would make a great president.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I know you've been out of the country, but surely you've heard about Donald Trump's escapades, calling women fat pigs and going after the Fox News debate person, Megyn Kelly, who was asking him questions about his remarks about women. I think you tweeted, it was kind of funny actually, have we thought about deporting Trump? Wasn't that your tweet from when you talked about the Mexicans a few weeks ago?
Look, I mean, Donald Trump was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He converted it into a gold-plated spoon and added so much glitter that every time he's been eating from this gold-plated spoon for his entire life, I think it's gone to his head and contaminated his thinking. I mean, the sad part about this is that having this entertainer running for president has really created a sideshow that takes us away from the important issues of the day. I brought Ambassador Nick Burns, who was President Bush's lead negotiator on Iran, down to speak to my colleagues in Washington about this deal. He's currently at the Kennedy School. And he said that this is the most important decision that Congress has had to make since Versailles.
Iran.
Iran. That's right. And here we are talking about Donald Trump's antics and his
I hate to be in this position because every time I have this discussion with Marjorie on the radio, she comes away with saying, oh, Browdy's a Trump supporter. I am so far from being a Trump supporter. There's a message in this madness. You are one of 535 people in the most dysfunctional – John King is with us every Tuesday. He is very measured, what he says. Most dysfunctional Congress in his lifetime. I would say you go back a few lifetimes. It seems to me the Trump message is horrible as the comments about women and the Mexican rapist and John McCain and others have been. Isn't there something that he is right on, is that Washington is totally broken? And I don't know if he has a solution. It doesn't appear like he does. But that's, at least in my estimation, one of the reasons he's connecting is because he's railing against a city and a body that can't fight its way out of a paper bag.
I don't think we need Donald Trump to tell us that Washington is broken. So it's more than that. But there are a lot of frustrations out there. A lot of Americans are frustrated. We don't have enough jobs. Students are getting crushed by student loan debt. There's too much dark money in the political system. There are a lot of things that we in Washington have to do a much better job of addressing. But we need someone who's talking about solutions, not just complaining about the problems. It's very much like the Iran deal. We don't need to just point out all the things that could be better about the deal. We need to talk about what real alternatives are on the table and what the best choice is given those alternatives.
You know, one of the things that from afar, and I think I'm like most Americans here, is this sick, unbridled partisanship is totally out of control. And I read a thing the other day that Richard Tesei, who we've had in here plenty of times, who was the Republican who you defeated, actually introduced you. Is this introduced you
right.
at an event? So why is the relationship between you and the man you beat so different from virtually every relationship that we see a couple hundred miles to the south? What's that about?
Well, I think it's about both of us really trying to make sure that we don't just repeat the nasty politics that's come to dominate the American political scene over the past 10 or 20 years. And so I sat down with him for coffee before I ran. I sat down, I met Congressman Tierney as well before I ran. And we exchanged cell phone numbers. We said, look, we need to try to conduct this race on a higher plane. And Richard Tesei and I, Senator Tesei, were both very proud that a national public, I think it was National Journal or something, held up our race as a model for how politics should be conducted. Since getting elected, I've called him to ask for advice. And I was incredibly flattered that he was willing to introduce me to a group in Danvers.
Did you ever call John Tierney for advice after you were elected?
Well, I've reached out to him. But
has he ever gotten back to you?
I haven't heard from him yet.
So you have not spoken to Tierney once since you won this election?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure working on what his next steps are and everything else. I've reached out to him, but I certainly hope that that at some point we can have the same kind of dialogue that I have right now with Richard Tesei.
We're talking with Congressman Seth Moulton from the 6th Congressional District. You know, for years we've heard about problems at the Veterans Hospital, and you had an extraordinary experience, a depressing experience at the Veterans Hospital. At one point, apparently, you thought you were getting Percocet, which is a strong painkiller, post it was a hernia operation you had there.
That's right.
And they gave you Advil instead?
Yeah, it didn't work so well.
Tell people what happened to you when you went to the VA hospital.
Well, I had made a commitment to my constituents and really to veterans across the country that I would continue to get my health care from the VA, even as a member of Congress. And I hurt myself lifting and needed to go in to get some surgery shortly after I was sworn in. So I went to the VA down in Washington and you know, checked in with my name and date of birth and Social Security number. Of course, they're supposed to have this world-renowned medical record system.
Yeah.
After about 25 minutes, they looked at me and said, we can't find your record, so we can't prove you're a veteran, but we'll consider taking you as a humanitarian case.
You only did four tours of duty. Is that correct? How many? Is it four?
Maybe five or six. They would have noticed.
And then you talk about how the records were going to be faxed down.
Well, then I explained. I said, look, I've been going to the VA in Boston for years.
Yeah.
So call them up. And they called several numbers and no one was there and whatnot. And then someone said they could fax. I mean, I didn't know people even had fax machines anymore. But they said they could fax the records down. And one of the VA employees says to the other, you know, hey, Joe, do you think this fax machine works? And he says, I certainly doubt it, but you can give it a shot.
And then even after they realized that you were a congressman, it didn't seem to change anything.
Well, they did eventually figure out that I was a congressman, and they certainly tried to give me the best care. And yet, when I took my bag of medicines and opened it up back in my office on Capitol Hill, it wasn't the right medications.
So you filed a bill. You filed a bill about this.
That's right. So we filed actually several bills that aim at addressing the pipeline of talent, the whole pipeline of talent in the VA, to make sure we're recruiting the right staff, that we're educating them while they're there, incentivizing them to improve their knowledge and their skills, and then trying to retain them. So these are incremental changes. We're working on some bigger picture changes right now, but I think they're important first steps. Every American agrees that we've got to take care of our veterans. I think veterans deserve the best health care in the world. And this isn't a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. It's an American issue.
Yeah. People waiting 6 and 7 hours in the waiting room. I couldn't believe that, and just to get into their appointment.
And that's the important point, is that, you know, all the stories about the fax machine and everything else, I mean, it would be funny, it would be a comedy if there weren't a dozen fellow veterans sitting in there in the waiting room, some of whom had been waiting for 5 or 6 hours just to get seen by someone.
We're talking to Congressman Seth Moult. We only have a minute or two left, and the good news is you're going to escape without us asking you about how you feel about being on the 50 most beautiful list in Washington. No, we're not, Marjorie. We're going to
left Joe Kennedy unfairly in the dust.
I knew she couldn't resist.
That's why I'm here. A great face for radio, right?
Two very quick things, and they deserve more time than this. Hillary Clinton, $350 billion to make education more affordable. And to her credit, I haven't even read the plan, the fact she's willing to attach a number and pay for it. Bernie Sanders, $750 billion, says how he'd pay for it. You were focused on community colleges, which I think is a great thing. Deval Patrick was, got nowhere. Barack Obama was, got nowhere. Quickly, if you can, what's the community college plan, Seth Moulton?
Well, I was a co-author of the legislation to make community college free for everybody who qualifies. And I think that this is an incredibly important step for education, not just the right thing to do morally, but frankly, a really good investment in our future, our investment in our economy. People say that the most successful piece of legislation ever passed by the U.S. Congress was the GI Bill, because for a dollar invested in the GI Bill, we got about $7 in return. Well, I think you'll see a similar kind of result with this community college bill.
Does this have a chance in hell? I mean, is there any chance for this?
Well, the fact that so many of the presidential candidates are now talking about it is certainly hopeful. Of course, the challenge is we do have to pay for it. The bill, it may in the long run pay for its costs, but in the short run, we've got to come up with
the funds.
How much
money are we talking about?
Secretary Clinton's plan is basically encompassing it. So we're talking, you know, on the order of billions of dollars.
Before you leave, the most important question, obviously, to everybody in this region is guilty or not guilty, Tom Brady. Which was the answer, please?
We live in a nation founded under the principle that you're innocent until proven guilty, and I certainly haven't seen any proof.
Oof. Absolutely. You could not be more
right,
Congressman.
Would you make this
Moulton.
Woman happy, Seth
That's
Moulton.
Right. Free Brady.
It's great to see
That's
you, Congressman.
My motto.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for coming in. Congressman Seth Moulton is a Democrat representing the 6th Congressional District. Thanks again, Congressman. Coming up, we are revisiting Deflategate off yesterday's hearing when an unsuspecting sketch artist took all the air out of the courtroom. Tom Brady and the Sketches. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.